the subject of today's sermon is a quote from the author Albert Camus, born in 1913, died in 1960. A French philosopher, author, and journalist, he won the Nobel Prize in 1957. Today we'll just be touching on one small part of Camus' vibrant life and thought, and I want to introduce the sermon with a video clip taken from a site maintained by an organization called the School of Life, founded by Alain de Botton. I spoke about Alain de Botton in the past. He has this vision that he's an atheist, an avowed atheist, but he sees a lot of value in churches. So he's tried to found an organization that preserves all the good things of churches without the dogma of any religion. The difference between that and Unitarianism, if you're wondering, is that the School of Life is kind of closed to this idea that there is no God, and we proceed from there. Unitarian Universalists have a much more open, broader tent, inviting people of all faith traditions to work together. But he's doing very well. This video has over 1 million viewers, and this is just one of many on his site. Camus was an atheist, but he had a spiritual bent. So here's a little summary.
Aside from The Outsider, Camus' fame rests on an essay published the same year as the novel called The Myth of Sisyphus. This book, too, has a bold beginning. There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living, that is the fundamental question of philosophy. The reason for this stark choice is, in Camus' eyes, because as soon as we start to think seriously, as philosophers do, we will see that life has no meaning, and therefore we will be compelled to wonder whether or not we should just be done with it all. To make sense of this rather extreme claim and thesis, we have to situate Camus in a history of thought. His dramatic announcement that we have to consider killing ourselves because life might be meaningless is premised on a previous notion that life could actually be rich in God-given meaning, a concept which will sound remote to many of us today. And yet we have to bear in mind that for the last 2,000 years in the West, a sense that life was meaningful was a given, accorded by one institution above any other, the Christian Church. Camus stands in a long line of thinkers from Kierkegaard to Nietzsche to Heidegger and Sartre who wrestle with a chilling realization that there is in fact no preordained meaning in life. We're just biological matter spinning senselessly on a tiny rock in a corner of an indifferent universe. We were not put here by a benevolent deity and asked to work towards salvation in the shape of the Ten Commandments. There's no roadmap and no bigger point. And it's this realization that lies at the heart of so many of the crises reported by the thinkers we now know as the existentialists. A child of despairing modernity, Albert Camus accepts that all our lives are absurd in the grander scheme, but unlike some philosophers, he ends up resisting utter hopelessness or nihilism. He argues that we have to live with the knowledge that our efforts will be largely futile, our lives soon forgotten, and our species irredeemably corrupt and violent, and yet we should endure nevertheless. We are like Sisyphus, the Greek figure ordained by the gods to roll a boulder up a mountain and to watch it fall back down again in perpetuity. But ultimately, Camus suggests we should cope as well as we can at whatever we have to do. We have to acknowledge the absurd background to existence and then triumph over the constant possibility of hopelessness.
This was Tanya's idea. The idea behind today's sermon, in fact, came from our director of religious exploration, and I'm very thankful for that. Because, as she explained in the silent auction some 2 years ago, I submitted the opportunity to select a topic for a sermon. She was the successful bidder. Thankfully, she's very patient. And now 2 years later, we have the results. The topic works perfectly with our theme for this month, the theme of resistance. I am no Camus scholar. There are people in this room here that know much more about Albert Camus than I do. Because I spent my university years in the Faculty of Engineering, where at least in my time there was little opportunity to study philosophy or literature. I'm now very fortunate in my life to be able to do something completely different. It's never too late, they say. I must say that Tanya's suggestion has ignited a curiosity in me for the works of Albert Camus. In my preliminary research, I find much in Camus' writing that is inspirational, despite the rather negative view presented in that slide. An aside, just for your general information, much of my research to date on Camus has been done on the internet. And when I was searching for that quotation in particular, I found a whole bunch of different references. I found the quote attributed to Camus with many different embellishments. It was part of a letter written to some woman. It had his follow-up comments behind it. It was like many, many different forms of the quote. And at first I thought Camus must have liked this phrase so much that he used it over and over in many different contexts. But I soon realized that a lot of those on the internet as quotes from Albert Camus were things he had simply never said at all. Someone just thought it was a good idea to attribute it to him. I even had one such quote all printed up for our meditation this morning, and then I realized it was totally bogus. It wasn't Albert Camus at all, so I had to start over again. Albert Camus, as we saw in the brief introduction, struggled with and found a way, and he did find a way to resist the existential angst that he felt when he confronted an apparently meaningless universe. Other philosophers faced with this dilemma tend toward nihilism. And nihilism has been described as a condition of tension, as a disproportion between what we want to value and what the world appears to value, how the universe appears to operate. Because to an indifferent observer, the universe appears to be totally indifferent to human concepts of compassion, love, and justice, for example. And yet, we want to instill these values with a transcendent significance. The video clip, rather disparagingly, implies that all belief in transcendent values has been swept away by our advancing scientific knowledge, and that a wider view and a fuller light lead inevitably to this nihilism. I don't intend to offer a counter-argument at this time, although I could, and I often have, and I will again in the future. But I hope that you were paying attention to the words in the opening hymn. You sang it very lustily. I hope you enjoyed and appreciated the actual words. Deborah carefully selects our hymns to build a cohesive service for all of us on Sunday. Both hymns this morning spoke directly to this theme. But I quote from the second verse of the opening hymn, words by Samuel Longfellow, where Camus saw no meaning in the advances of science, that science was just showing us how meaningless our life were, is, Samuel Longfellow saw it differently. In the hymn we sang, with wider view come loftier goals, with fuller light, more good to see, with freedom, truer self-control, and with knowledge, deeper reverence be. As we saw in the introductory video, Camus opens his essay Sisyphus with these words: there is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. I mentioned that I was inspired by what little I had learned about Camus' writing. There's another quotation that I find more uplifting. He said, "You will never be happy if you continue to search for what happiness consists of. You will never live if you are looking for meaning in life." Now that may sound rather negative. You will never be happy if you are looking for meaning in life. I think Camus was saying that looking for meaning is futile. It isn't out there. It isn't under a rock somewhere. It isn't something you can just discover and then share with everyone else. But each of us has an amazing capacity to give meaning to our lives. Well, now with half my allotted time gone, I'll begin to address the question that, and the quotation that Tanya had asked me to address. In the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer. When you place that quotation in the context of Camus' essay, Return to Tipasa, you see that this discovery of an invincible summer within is in the context of witnessing the dawn of a new day in all its natural glory. I quote again from the prelude to the quote, "I listen to an almost forgotten sound within me, as if my heart long stopped were calmly beginning to beat again and to awake now. I recognize one by one the imperceptible sounds of which the silence was made up. The figured bass of the birds, the sea's faint brief sighs at the foot of the rocks, the vibration of the trees, the blinding singing of the columns, the rustling of the wormwood plants and the furtive lizards." Camus is telling us that within each of us, a new beginning awaits to emerge, an opportunity for a fresh start, a new day. This is what sustains us in the depths of winter, both literally and figuratively. It is the knowledge that the grueling days of winter need not go on indefinitely. We have the invincible power, the irresistible force of spring and summer within us. And this isn't hope for spring. This is the invincible spring. Invincible. A force too powerful to be denied. And it's in the very nature of what we call life. Somehow, on an indifferent, pointless, and purposeless universe, life has arisen. Life began on this planet, a planet that was anything but hospitable to life as we know it now. And life itself, working with otherwise indifferent processes, has turned an inhospitable piece of rock without any free oxygen into a veritable Garden of Eden. Life has survived every imaginable winter, from the literal snowball frozen Earth, an Earth frozen from pole to pole, to the cataclysm of asteroid collisions multiple times. And life has brought forth you and me, from the cosmic to the personal. On a personal level, what sustains you when you're faced with a metaphorical winter? The answer to that question among Unitarian Universalists is as unique as the individuals who make up our faith tradition. For some, the invincible summer is a belief in God, an unshakable belief in God. God in some form that we may not even be able to articulate. A belief that there is an answer to the question, why? Camus' overarching philosophical question of suicide is really the question, why? Why does anything exist? If there's no answer to the why, then whether we live or die is of no consequence. Camus certainly was not sustained by a belief in God. It might be said that he was sustained by an ironic sense of humor. For reasons unknown, we find ourselves in a seemingly absurd reality where there is no transcendent meaning, but there are many delights to be appreciated and to be sampled, and while we have the energy to do so. And so Camus lived his life with gusto. He died like a lot of people who live the way he did died, in relative youth, in a car accident. Traveling with, I think, his business manager in a sports car. And ironically, he had a ticket for a train in his pocket. He had planned to take the train instead of going in the car, and at the last minute he was talked into getting in the car. Live fast, love hard, die young. But even Camus was sustained by self-discipline. You can't be a successful author, you can't have the career that this man had without self-discipline. For someone with multiple wives and simultaneous mistresses, and the love of money and the trappings that come with it, self-discipline may not seem an appropriate sustaining principle. But Camus managed to live successfully in a complex society. He pushed the boundaries, but he still lived within boundaries, up to his untimely death in that car crash. For others, it's a faith in humanity that sustains us. In looking at materials on the theme of resistance, for example, I came across the work of Erica Chenoweth, a PhD. She's spent her career in analyzing human conflict and resistance. And she had had a predisposition that the world changed because of forceful action taken by people. But she wrote, "In analyzing the data and the result, I analyzed the data and the results blew me away. From 1900 to 2006, it was nonviolent campaigns worldwide that were twice as likely to succeed outright as violent insurgencies. People of goodwill united in nonviolent causes changed the world. It is that faith in the invincible summer that is giving courage to the indigenous people of Canada. It is passion that sustains them. It's been said that the passion of resistance that validates the survival and the resilience of the First Nations people and communities provides hope for healing and reconciliation over the next seven generations. The invincible summer may be a long time coming, but it is invincible." I've touched on the source of our invincible summer, whether that be faith in nature and a reverence for nature, a faith in God, a faith in humanity, self-discipline and willpower, the ability to give our life meaning, and in all of it somehow a sense of humor. Because failing all of those, we can be sustained by a sense of humor. But ultimately, to look around this room, it's our community that sustains us through our metaphorical winter. No human being is self-made. No human being survives alone. We depend on one another, in families, in neighborhoods, in cities, and in countries, and in global institutions, and in voluntary associations like this congregation. It's my hope and expectation that members and friends of this congregation will recognize and act upon their calling to nurture the invincible summer that exists within the heart of everyone in this room. May it be so, and amen.